We're going to start off another class, and what we're going to do is we're going to entertain certain questions, and then we'll veer off a little bit into some topics, and Bezat Hashem, we'll try and tie them all together. Okay, so the first question, the first topic that we're going to, or the random, or seemingly random piece of information we're going to put together, is the Bracha Birkot HaShachar. Interestingly enough, in Birkot HaShachar, which is the blessing that we say in the morning upon arrival, we start off our first blessing as follows. I know it's like a little bit warm in here, it's just because of the recording, other than that, I'm fine. Blessed are you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, who gave the heart understanding to distinguish between day and night. Right? So the first blessing we say is, heart has two translations. Heart has a translate, sikhvi is translated as heart, and it's also translated as heart. So here, we're talking about distinguishing between day and night. That's the first thing we say upon arrival. You know, you wake up in the morning, you say Modani, you say Birkot HaShachar, and you talk about distinguishing between day and night. So what we have to discuss a little bit is, what's the significance of starting off praising the Almighty, that He gives us the capability to distinguish between day and night, and the rooster, which is the literal translation, is, you know, given that power. Alright? The second point that we want to discuss is in Shulchan Aruch, which is the code of all Jewish law, starts off with a very interesting halakha. Okay, Shulchan Aruch is a book of law. There's different types of books. There's a book of law, and there's a book of, you know, musal, philosophy, self-growth, things like that. When you start a book of law, the first thing that you're going to say is a law, right? Doesn't that make like logical sense? However, the Shulchan Aruch starts with the following. It says like this. It says that when a person wakes up, he should awaken the dawn. Right? It says, "Hu yo'er ha-shachar." When a person wakes up, he should wake up like a lion. "Hu yo'er et ha-shachar." Right? "Hu yo'er et ha-shachar." What does that mean? "Hu yo'er ha-shachar." I mean, the person should wake up, and he should be the one to wake up dawn. Now, if I was starting a halacha book, the first thing I would write would be a halacha. A halacha, for example, I would say, you know, do netilat yadayim, I don't know, how to get dressed, all kinds of stuff like that. Don't get upset that, you know, you missed your bus, you know, that's the first thing you woke up. But I wouldn't say you should wake up, you know, the dawn. It's not halacha. That's the first, the second point. The third thing we're going to talk about is Havdalah. On Motzei Shabbat, when Shabbat is out, we light a candle to distinguish between Shabbat and between weekday. Okay? So, lighting a candle between Shabbat and a weekday, and we want to talk about, you know, what the significance specifically is of the stress between separating between Shabbat and a weekday. Now here's a little bit of background information. There is a korban called a todah. Korban todah. Now this was a very interesting korban for two reasons. First of all, it was made up of chametz and matzah. The second thing is, this is one of the sacrifices that is made up of chametz and matzah that will not cease in the times of Mashiach. So this will continue even in the times of Mashiach. Which is very odd, because what's the purpose of a korban? The purpose of korban is atonement. But here, there's no concept of atonement in the times of Mashiach. You know, what's done is done, so to speak. So the question is, why is it that this korban todah, this sacrifice that within it is composed of chametz and matzah, will not cease, even in the times of Mashiach? Right? And the last interesting question or point that we're going to bring up is the following. The Gemara in Brachot, the Gemara says the following. The Gemara in Brachot, it says that Moshe Rabbeinu told the Egyptians, he said to them, when, you know, kechatzot laila, around the time of midnight, the Almighty will come out and he will take his children out of bondage. So kechatzot laila, the Almighty will take out. Now, there are opinions that say that one of the reasons he said kechatzot laila is because he didn't know when the exact point of midnight was. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know the exact point of midnight, so he said around midnight. He didn't want to be caught on anything, and he didn't want to say something that wasn't true. And he said, around midnight, the Almighty will come out and take out his children from slavery. So the question that we want to talk about is, why did Moshe Rabbeinu have a hard time finding out exactly what point midnight is? I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu was quite an intelligent person, definitely above average. So I mean, he would have done pretty well in his SATs, I'm sure. Why would he have not been able to just check his watch or his hourglass and say, okay, this is when Chatzot is? Obviously, there's a deeper significance of what it means that Moshe Rabbeinu did not know what Chatzot. Okay, so let's just go over some of the points that we were talking about. First of all, we say in the first point we want to bring up is, while upon arising in the morning, why is the first thing we thank the Almighty is for having a rooster that is able to differentiate between the day and the night, right? Why does the Almighty, and the blessing is we have a rooster that's able to differentiate between the day and the night. The second thing is, so meaning within itself, it's an interesting point. And then that's how we start our day. Thanks for the rooster. I really appreciate it. You know, even if you want to translate according to heart, but you want to start off your day with differentiating between day and night. Shulchan Aruch, the second thing we want to speak about is that the Shulchan Aruch says when you start your day, you should awaken the dawn. He is the one that should awaken the dawn. So again, the Shulchan Aruch is a book of halakha, of law. You know, it's nice if you want to say, you know, a philosophy book or something like that, or something to work on your personality, or however you want. But when you start a law book, you write a law, especially the first thing, right? Many of us, when we check out a book, check out the first page. And that's it. Afterwards, we put it down. I don't want this book. It's not for me. Right? Flip through it. We'll just open it and flip through the pages, just like sort of hear the rustle of the pages here, and then that's how it'll help us decide if it's a good book or not, depending on where we end. You know, where the cover is nice and savvy. Rabbi Yosef Karo starts his book off with, you should awaken the dawn. Now, the third point we're talking about is Havdalah, and lighting a candle. Why is it done specifically in this fashion and such a stress, you know, such a strong stress on separating between day and night? The fourth point we're talking about is Korban Todah, which is an oddity. There are two things that are odd about it. First of all, it's a mixture of chametz and matzah, and bread, right? It's a mixture of both. And the second thing that's interesting about it is that it's the type of Korban that will continue even when Mashiach comes, even though there's really no point of a sacrifice at that point. The fifth thing is, like we said, why did Moshe Rabbeinu not know when Chatzot was? Like, what does that mean, he doesn't know when Chatzot is? Check your hourglass. He would have gone online and gone to clock.com, and then he would have figured it out. Right? Right. Alright. Anybody want to have anything that ties these things together? To start on our little journey, we do need to answer the fact. We need to paint a little bit of a picture. Okay. The first thing we're going to talk about is Eliyahu HaNavi. Okay. So, now, Eliyahu HaNavi had a very, very interesting experience with the Jewish people. His experience was as follows. He told the Jewish people had a problem at that time, and that was that they were serving Nevi'ei HaBaal. Now what they did was something very challenging and very interesting. And it had its roots, today it exists, unfortunately, but it started already even back then. What was that? The Jewish people would go to the synagogues, and they would go to the houses of the Bet Midrash, and the houses of Jewish study. But afterwards, you know, they would go to the houses of idol worship. So it was like they were doing both things at once. And Eliyahu Navi was especially perturbed by this. He was especially bothered by it, more than them just serving idols. He said, listen guys, you know, we can't, this is not, you know, this is not a game anymore. We're going to have a contest. Now you have to understand that in those times, we have to understand that in those times there was no such thing as serving idols outside of the Beit Mikdash. And Eliyahu Navi said, in those times there was no such thing as having a korban outside of the Beit Mikdash. So Eliyahu Navi came up with a chidush. What did he say? He said, we are going to actually sacrifice outside of the temple, which wasn't something that was permitted at the time. He got permission to do that at that time because of the need of the generation. So Eliyahu Navi comes forth and he brings everybody towards Halakah Men. Does anybody know what happened in Halakah Men? Anybody know what happened in Halakah Men? No one? Who has an idea? A very interesting thing. He put together all of the Jewish people on Halakah Men, which in itself was a miracle. And he said the following. He said, we're going to have a contest between us and the Nevi'ei HaBaal. We're going to have a contest. What was the contest? Everybody gets to offer korbanot, to offer sacrifices. You're going to have your group on the right, and we're going to have our group on the left. And whoever's fire comes down and burns the sacrifice, that means that they are the true God. Now this wasn't, you know, this was something that only because of the times did God permit it. Now what happened? The Nevi'ei HaBaal knew, of course, that they were mistaken, and they knew that they weren't doing the right thing. So they planted a guy under the whole structure, and he was going to light the entire, you know, structure, and thereby the people would think that, you know, the fire came from the heavens. And in the truth, before they even, they set up a fire, you know, concoction or whatnot, and the two goats didn't want to go. One of them said, okay, I'm willing to go to the Jewish side, but I don't want to go. The other goat said, like, why should I go and be a sacrifice? I don't want to do that. So Eliyahu Navi like whispered into its ear and he said, don't worry, it's okay, you're serving God as well, you're going to be an example. And they lied this person underneath this whole fire structure, and they're all dancing around the Nevi'ei HaBaal, and they're all, you know, singing and whatnot, and obviously no fire comes down. Why? Guy was underneath, you know, trying to work the matches, and God did a miracle. What was the miracle? The miracle was that God sent a snake underneath to kill him, and the snake killed the person that was underneath the whole fire structure, and the fire never went off. So Eliyahu Navi was making fun of them. He said, maybe your God is sleeping, maybe he's got a stomach ache, maybe he's in the bathroom, you know, he's making fun of them. Finally Eliyahu Navi turns to his, you know, fire structure with the sacrifice, and he pours water on it. Pours water on it, and he just says like a few words, and all of a sudden a huge fireball comes down from the heavens and burns his sacrifice, burns the idol worship, burns all the priests. You know, everything there is just set on fire. And then Eliyahu Navi turns to the Jewish people, and he says the most interesting statement. He says, "Im Hashem wa Elokim, lechu acharav. If God is a true God, follow him. Im Baal Elokim, lechu acharav. If the Baal is the true God, follow him. But don't do both." How do you understand the statement of Eliyahu Navi? What's questionable about his statement? What don't you understand about it? What did he say? If God is the true God, then what should you do?
Make a choice, not
follow him. What if a person comes to the conclusion that the Nevi'ei HaBaal is the true God, then what should he do? And you should follow him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you? Is it better that a person follows the Nevi'ei HaBaal?
Choose one.
Nevi'ei HaBaal means
the God, the idol worship. Why is it worse to do both? Eliyahu Navi is saying, if God is a true God, follow him. If the Baal is a true God, follow him. But don't do both. Why is doing both worse?
Because of your own individual
plan. You'd rather him not go to, you know, not do anything?
But if you really have to follow someone else?
Doing it faithfully, don't do it at all.
So the aspect is, right, it's similar to what you guys were saying. Meaning that what? That we have to understand that there's a certain, imagine, you know, a person, Chas v'Shalom, right? A person, a husband comes home. Right, and he was caught being dishonest to his wife. How would the wife feel if he came up and said, "Well, you know, I love you too. You love me too. I don't need, that's not the type of love that I want." Meaning what? There's a certain, you know, it's one thing if a person is doing something wrong, if he's just serving idol worship. It's one thing if he's keeping Judaism. But if he's mixing both, then you're making a mockery of God. Right? So the one of the biggest forms of evil that, you know, could exist is making a mockery of the Almighty. Is in a sense like dancing at two weddings at once. Now, this shouldn't be confused with a person who's on a growth process and might not be keeping all of Judaism, because he's on his way up and it just sort of takes time until you get there. That might be something else, right? But a person who says, no, it's okay to keep A and B at the same time, that in a sense is really making a mockery of God. And that's what Eliyahu Navi was saying. Eliyahu Navi was saying, listen, if God is the true God, follow him. If Baal is the true God, follow him, but don't do both, because that's worse than just following the Baal. So we have here, you know, we have an interesting point. The interesting point is that mixing light, you know, and darkness at the same time can sometimes be more insulting to God than just by doing the wrong thing, in a sense, right? And We do have an example of this in world history. Does anybody know when a nation that represents the concept of mixing good and evil together? Esav had Esav, you know, created the dynasty of Amalek, right? And what Esav had a son. His son's name was Eliphaz. And Eliphaz did something very interesting. Eliphaz, Yaakov Avinu was running away from Esav because he was going to kill him. So Esav sent Eliphaz to go and get him. And when he catches up with him, what does he tell him? What does Eliphaz wants to kill him? What does Yaakov Avinu tell him to save his life? You know? You guys know?
I have gifts for your father.
Take away my clothes and make me poor. Then what happens? Once I'm considered poor, a poor person is considered as if he's dead, right? And therefore, you can tell your father that you killed me. Now, what was going through Eliphaz's mind? Eliphaz was saying, on the one hand, I have a commandment to kill you. What's my commandment? Kibud avim. I have to respect my father. On the other hand, I know it's not good to kill. Now, interesting to point out, what was propelling his desire or will to kill Yaakov Avinu? The commandment of Kibud Av V'Em.
Honoring your mother and father?
Yes, because his father told him he had to kill Yaakov Avinu. He knew it was wrong, because he grew up in the house of Yitzchak. However, it was the commandment of Kibud Av V'Em that was purporting him to kill Yaakov Avinu. So you have here a certain monstrosity called Amalek. That what is it? It's taking the truth and twisting it. But it's not just taking the truth and twisting it. It's combining evil and light and goodness at the same time. It's a propelled monstrosity it's one thing if a person is doing something wrong, to have a guilty conscience. Another thing if a person is doing something right. But to use the good to propel the evil and twist it, that is like the highest level of evil. In fact, when they had the whole issue with 9/11, how did they know that it was the fact that the people that were there gave up their lives, they knew that only, you know, a religious, somebody propelled by religion could bring himself to, you know, to give up his life and take up his life for the sake of others. There's no other energy, there's no other force that can convince a person to give up his own life in such a fashion, really, you know, to take others. So that's similar to what we're talking about. It's the concept of taking what's supposed to be good, of getting to a level where you take what's supposed to be good, and that goodness turns into the evil of that fire is the flame for your actions. Okay, now that's what happens when you combine evil and good together. And worse is when you use the evil for, you know, when you use the evil or you use the good for your own evil purposes. Now this interesting point is actually behind the storyline of Paro. We had an interesting dream, right? Remember what was the dream of Paro? Who remembers the dream with the cows? It's in Shemot, chapter 41, verse 3 and 4. Okay? Let's read it in the order that it appears. Verse 3 and 4. Here. Right? Paro was dreaming that, behold, he was standing over the river, and out of the river emerged seven cows of beautiful appearance and robust flesh, and they were grazing in the marshland. So what appeared first? Appeared the seven healthy cows, right? Then behold, seven other cows emerged after them out of the river, of ugly appearance and gaunt flesh, and they stood next to the cows on the bank river. Now what appeared second was the ugly cows, the thin cows. So first you have the healthy cows, and standing next to them appears the thin cows. Now that's not enough. The cows of ugly appearance and gaunt flesh ate the seven cows of beautiful appearance and robust, and Paro awoke. So you have here an interesting procession. You have the healthy flesh cows, the fat cows, the good ones, and then you have, they appear first, and then appears the evil skinny cows, the ones that are like, you know, the ones that are representing the 7 years of famine. And then what happens is they're standing next to each other, and the ones that are skinny eat or swallow up the fat cows, the healthy cows, the robust ones. So the Sfat Emet says, he says, what's the depth of this dream? He says the following, that the way things work in the heavens is the Almighty will send down, will shower us with blessing. The Almighty will send us, you know, bracha, and that's representative of the seven healthy cows. Now, what does evil do? Evil first creeps up next to the blessings that we receive and just stands next to it. Doesn't do anything. After it stands next to it, and you're not nervous about being around the evil, what ends up happening is that the evil encompasses and swallows up the good and takes everything into its own. That's the same thing we were talking about regarding Eliphaz and Amalek, meaning the good enters into the evil, and the evil has swallowed it all up for its own purposes, uses it for itself. Right? Now, what Yosef, the only way Yosef was able to break out of it, Yosef had this attribute of truth, where he was able to see in between evil and good. Where do we know this from? From what happened with Yosef was the following. He, if you remember, Eshet Potiphar, right? It's this woman that was trying to seduce him constantly. Said that she did everything within her power to seduce him. Right? She would change her clothes, and she would make him wear certain neck braces that he would have to lift his head and look at her. Now, what was purporting her? Our sages say that he was one of the most handsome men in creation, and she couldn't, you know, she couldn't control herself. However, there was something else that was on her mind. What it was that she was looking into the stars, and she saw that the combination of Yosef and her was going to come holy offspring. And so she said, she saw in the stars that from the combination of Yosef and her is going to come holy offspring. So now what she was thinking was, this was a holy connection. Meaning what? From me is going to come the 12 tribes. That's what she saw in the tribe, in the stars. Yeah, she saw in the stars, and there's a chokhmah in the stars, there's a wisdom in the stars, there's no question about it. If you have the wisdom, you can check into the stars. The only thing that she misunderstood was that she didn't know that it was her daughter, who was actually from the house of Yaakov, taken also, was the one that was going to marry Yosef, and from there came the tribes. She thought it was her. But Yosef, you know, she told this to Yosef, and Yosef had the clarity of mind to separate between the good and the evil. He was able to separate, in a sense, from between those two cows, between the healthy cows and the evil cows, and that's why Yosef was able to open up, you know, the boundaries of all the food and all that all those. That's what that whole issue represents. It's not just a storyline. It's saying that the attribute of truth that stood for Yosef is able to separate between good and evil. Because the danger of what evil does is, like we said, it swallows up the good, and then it takes credit for it, and then it uses it as its own power, you know, to do what it wants. That was the deep representation, says the Sfat Emet, of the, you know, of what the dream of Paro represents. In truth, this also, if we know the storyline of our sages, why is it that what happened is that the Yosef ran back inside to the house, and Eshet Potiphar was there, so she grabs him by his vest, and he was about to succumb to sin. What stopped him?
His father's
image. Why? What's special about his father's image that stopped him? Why not his mother's image? Okay. Does anybody know what Yaakov stood for? Yaakov stood for Emet, truth. Titen Emet LeYaakov. That's the verse. You should give truth to Yaakov. Meaning what? It was the power of truth that was able to give him the vision to see that even though in the stars it says that the union between me and you is going to produce offspring, that's the connection, you know, to the 12 tribes. But his father was able to give him the clarity that this is not it. This is not the path. So you need, in order to separate between good and evil, especially when they get mixed up in such a form, you need a tremendous sense of truth. Because not everyone could do that, or not in every situation is a person have the luxury of being able to separate between good and evil. Sometimes a person might intend to do something and it's against the will of the Almighty. You know, steal from the rich and give to the poor. It sounds like great in theory, but who says it's right? Right? Even though in our own frame of mind it might be true. Yeah. It's very interesting to know that specifically regarding Pesach, there's a concept of not eating chametz. What's the difference between chametz and matzah?
Unleavened bread.
How much time?
18 minutes.
Well, right, 18 minutes is up until 18 minutes. What happens in 18 minutes and a second? What is it called?
Chametz.
Right? So the difference between chametz, which is representative of the yetzer hara, the evil inclination, because he's all, you know, hot air, so to speak, and matzah, which is representative of the good inclination, or the, you know, the angel of good, is how much time? Could be just a second. Meaning it's a fine line between the evil inclination of sin and the line of success of doing the right thing. And specifically on Pesach, we commemorate this aspect of, you know, separating between the evil inclination and the, you know, the Yetzer HaTov. And we're trying to, the message is that at certain times it's 1 second, it's one step to the left or one step to the right that might, you know, decide whether or not this is, you know, of true value or it's against God's will. Okay, now in essence that's why only the Almighty was able to go down and do Makat Bechorot, because Makat Bechorot, which was the final plague, the plague of the firstborn, only the Almighty could really delve into the depth of the Egyptians and the Jews and know exactly who has to be killed and who has to be spared, meaning separating between the good, which is the Jewish people, and the evil, which was the Egyptians at that time. We need the clarity that only Almighty has. Like we saw with Yosef, the only thing that was able to give him the power to succeed was something heavenly, his father's image. Right? Because in order to separate between good and evil, if a person just bases himself on his own train of thought, it might not be enough. Now, the Ben Ish Chai, the Ben Ish Chai speaks about the power of Chatzot, midnight. Okay, one of the questions that we asked was talking about the aspect of separation between day and night. Now, the Ben Ish Chai speaks about Chatzot. He explains, what is Chatzot? Chatzot is midnight. Midnight does not mean what we call 12 o'clock, you know, when the apple falls. I don't know if they have that in England. In New York, they have like at 12 o'clock the apple falls. You guys have that? The Ben Ish Chai says that the way the day works is as follows. The time that the evil inclination has the most strength is after sunset up until midnight. That's why if you look, that's why God made the world in such a way that we sleep generally at that time, especially in the days of old when they didn't have lights and things like that. Once it gets dark, there's nothing for anybody to do. They would go to sleep and they would wake up early. Why? Because that's the least productive time during the day, spiritually. Meaning the evil inclination has the most grasp at that point of the day. Right? Once that point of the day arrives, it's like his domain. And if you think about it, night has this like attribute or aspect of like sinister about it. You know what I mean? It's hard to like go out partying at 12 o'clock in the afternoon. It just doesn't flow. As soon as sunset happens, from that point until midnight is the evil inclination's most powerful time. Okay, so that's what we're going to talk about. So now, meaning the time that's the least powerful spiritually is from sunset until midnight. Says the Ben Ish Chai, as soon as midnight comes, it's a changing of the guard. The evil inclination loses its power drastically, and at that point, he flips over and he starts to deteriorate. Until when? Until dawn. Dawn, he's at the nets, sunrise. That's when he's at his weakest. But the significance of midnight, says the Ben Ish Chai, is like that is the. It's up until then he's on his he's on the rise, he's climbing up. Once he gets to midnight, he's already falling down, because that's the changing of the guard. So, when it says, for example, we spoke about the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know exactly when midnight was, and he wasn't able to give it over to the Egyptians. The significance of that is. Before midnight represents the evil inclination. That's the time that he's in his most power. After midnight is already the domain of the Yetzer HaTov, the good angel, so to speak. And that's why it's in all truth you find that the Kabbalists sleep after sunset until midnight, and they wake up at midnight to learn until the morning. Because it's at that point that the Almighty ordained that he loses his, that up until then is when he loses his power. It's the real essence of like darkness. After the sun has set until midnight, and it's at that, and after midnight is when, you know, they start saying, even Elpi Halacha, you say Birkot HaShachar, right, the morning blessings, you say them after midnight if you wake up, because it's that point. Midnight has a significance of the, it represents the fact that the evil inclination loses its power. So what that means is when Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know exactly the point of midnight, meaning he did not have the tool to discern exactly between the powers of good and evil, that knife that slices them exactly in half is not in human hands. Only God could come down and reveal the true point at which is, you know, this is good and that's evil. So otherwise, you know, if it's just something that's right, if it's just something that's pending on time, then there's no reason why Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't figure that out. If he could figure out how to lead the Jewish people 40 years, which I'm sure was much more difficult than looking at an hourglass, then he could for sure figure out when midnight is. The answer is, it wasn't midnight that he was troubled with. It's that aspect of separating between good and evil, and knowing exactly how to slice it in half. Because we know that if you overstep them, like we saw with Eliphaz, you mix up the good and the evil, the good can become your biggest energy to do the evil. Like we spoke about the fact that Eliphaz, the whole motion that pushed him to kill Yaakov was just the commandment of, you know, respecting my father. Well, my father said I have to kill you, that's why I have to kill you. So to have that exact knife, you have to be dependent, you know, exactly on the Almighty. That's what it means that he didn't know how to, you know, didn't know exactly the point of midnight. Now, I want to relate to you a true and shocking story. There was a certain rabbi, you know, that. You know, it's very commonly accepted that everybody in our generation is a Gilgul, reincarnation. There's a certain rabbi a certain Hasidic rabbi that says he remembered his reincarnation. He remembers who he was. So the students asked him, who were you in your previous reincarnation? So he says like this. He says that he was in the generation of Moshe Rabbeinu and Korach. There was a machloket, there's an argument between Moshe Rabbeinu and Korach. You study the Chumash, you see that there's somebody named Korach who, you know, got up and argued on Moshe Rabbeinu, and the Almighty had to create a new being in creation to kill him. was like a certain earthquake, that everything that he was connected to got sucked down under the ground. So his student says, so where were you? I remember that I was in that generation. He said, where were you? He said, well, there were three parties. There was Moshe Rabbeinu. There was a party of Moshe Rabbeinu that was with him. There was his group. Then there was the group that was with Korach, that was against Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeah, there's a group that was with Korach. And then there was a group that was in the middle that didn't know where to go. He said, I was in the group that was in the middle that didn't know where to go. He said, what do you mean? You didn't know if Moshe Rabbeinu was true or not? He said, well, we were confused. What do you mean you were confused? He says, he says to them, you think Korach was this, like, you know, little kid? You know, imagine what it would take for someone to get up and argue on Moshe Rabbeinu, who was the vehicle for the 10 plagues, who was the vehicle of the splitting of the sea, who was the vehicle of bringing down the Torah. You needed some massive person to come down and shake the foundations. It couldn't be just anybody. He said to them, you think Korach was just like little kid? He says he knew Torah. He used the power of good for his own purpose and was able to confuse the nation. So here we have here, like, you know, to be able, sometimes you have the situation of good and evil, and to separate truly between them, it takes like big shoulders sometimes, right? It takes the clarity of the Almighty, the clarity of Yaakov Avinu, to be able to separate them. That's what he said. That's why he said he didn't know which way to go. Now, when we'd asked, one of the questions we'd asked is, why is it that a person has to awaken the dawn? What does it mean a person should, you know, awaken the dawn? So in a symbolic level, and this is what the Mefarshim explained, these are not my words, the aspect is like this. Dawn is the time in a person's life of clarity. Right? That's the time that the sun rises. That's the time the sun is coming up. Night is representative of darkness. When it says that you should be awakening the dawn, why did the Shulchan Aruch start his halachot, the book of Jewish law, why did it start it with this concept of awakening the dawn? Because a person has to turn. The only way that a person can possibly have true clarity and true know exactly what the will of the Almighty is if they search into the book of Jewish laws, they search into the Torah and use that to create clarity. Meaning, when you should awaken the dawn, when the Shulchan Aruch starts off his book and says, yes, you should be the one that's responsible to shed light, and then he starts teaching you the laws, the obvious implication is that when you follow the laws, that's what's going to bring you light. And we see that those, you know, movements, for example, that pick and choose in Judaism, what ends up with them. It gets to a level where there's almost no remnants of Judaism within their places of worship, their places of prayer, or even with amongst the people themselves. Why is that so? Because you have to be the one that's following the Torah with what it says, and thereby shedding the light on your life. And that's quite clear. You know, if we think about all the reform movements and that, when they started out as people that we would call, if we would look at them today, we would say these are rabbis. These are people that know Torah and are knowledgeable in it. But what happens is when you change and deviate, then even a little bit, then what ends up happening is you have a movement that almost doesn't look significantly Jewish. It has issues with, you know, that aspect of it. Because again, the only way to shed light is by far, only God knows the true essence of what's right and what's wrong. Even Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have complete clarity on it. So only God knows. We have to rely on His work in order to be able to, you know what's right and what's not. And that's the aspect of Havdalah. What's Havdalah? Havdalah is a time when a person has to light a match, he has to light a fire, and separate between Shabbat and a weekday, between holy and non-holy. Why? Because you need God to command us to do that. Because what would we think? We would think, just let's keep the entire week Shabbat. Why create this concept of weekday b'chlal? But the Almighty comes and says, no, this is how you should separate. You should have a division between them, because this is your purpose in the world. Your purpose in the world is to take, you know, the materialism, is to take the weekday and to separate them and to use it and to live it. Right? So when the Almighty commands us of Havdalah, is in the beginning of the week, He's telling us when you're about to encounter 6 days of materialism, you should just know that if you want to succeed and have it in the proper way, you have to follow the divisions that I said is right. You have to follow my path of how exactly to make it up.
Right? And that's the whole essence of the Torah. That's the significance of, for example, having a rabbi. The rabbi is not any smarter than you are. You know your life probably better than he does. Right? Not necessarily is he smarter. It's not. You're not going to him because he's any wiser. The reason that you're turning to rabbi for advice or for direction because he has the power of Torah under his belt. Right? And that's the whole concept of Tavdalah, knowing how to separate between holiness and, you know, mundane, and what boundaries everything should be in. In addition, we'd spoken, for example, about the Korban Todah. The Korban Todah is made up of chametz, and matzah, meaning what it represents is, and it's specifically the sacrifice that will last, that will be given in the world to come. Why is that? The answer is quite clear. Because of the fact that in the world to come, what's going to happen there is materialism and spirituality are going to be one. In this world right now, they're separated. We can't always seem to put them together. But in the world to come, there's going to be a sacrifice that's called Korban Todah, that's going to be made up of unleavened bread, right, and leavened bread. It's going to be made of chametz and matzah together. And that is the exact sacrifice of Mashiach, of the world to come, because that's what world to come represents. World to come represents the perfection of the materialism. It represents the aspect of taking everything materialistic and purporting it to a spiritual level, of combining it and making it one, revealing that nothing in this world was, you know, just purely one or the other. Everything was the desire of the Almighty. So it's specifically that Korban, that in this world we can't figure out how to put both together. You know, a sacrifice that has chametz and matzah together, that has something that, you know, are two opposites. The one represents the evil inclination, one represents spirituality. But in all reality, in the world to come, we're going to see clearly how the Almighty set boundaries for everything and how everything worked in unison. But again, that's something that's dependent, you know, only specifically on the Almighty. You know, it's similar. My father, Sheikh, always says, like, when you take an arrow and you move it over a little bit, you draw a circle on the wall, and you, instead of pointing it straight, you're standing, like, you know, half a block away. You'll move it over just a drop. What's going to happen when it gets down to the circle area? If I move it over from here just a little bit, that much, a block or two away, what's going to be? Is it going to get anywhere near the point? Not at all. Why? Because when you move a little bit at the beginning, at the end, you see a tremendous difference. So here too, you know, the only real way to separate between good and evil and to know exactly what is the desire of the Almighty is by asking the Almighty and looking into His book and seeing what He demands. When we take things on our own accord, then we get the sense of confusion of we could actually do something wrong when we think it's right. You think Koach was thinking that he was sinning? Of course not. He thought he was doing the right thing. We hear by all the parables that he said. For example, he said to the Jewish people, he said, a room full of Sifre Torah, does it need a mezuzah? Meaning you have a room that's full of Torah scrolls, which in the Torah scrolls is what's written in the mezuzah. Do you need a mezuzah? Obviously not. What he was saying was, we're all holy. We don't need Moshe Rabbeinu to lead us. He had, you know, pure intentions. But when you don't follow the exact rules... Now, I want to end off with... I think we've answered all of the questions, right? And we pointed out, you know, the theme of everything. We spoke about why Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know Chatzot. What does it mean he didn't know Chatzot? So we said, you know, we said that when he didn't know Chatzot, meaning that point of separating between good and evil is something that you have to really rely on the balance of the Almighty to. We spoke about the Korban Todah, the separation between, you know, the Chametz and the Matzah is, and why in the world to come it's going to be one. And the significance of Havdalah, right, starting off your week with this form of, you know, separating between materialism and spirituality. Again, the Almighty knows how to put it into boundaries. We spoke about the Shulchan Aruch as well. And the last point we want to speak about, after I'll end off with the story, is that we spoke about when the person wakes up in the morning, he says, you know, I'm thanking the rooster for separating between day and night. So I think now it really makes a lot of sense. Why do we start our day praising the Almighty for giving us the capability of separating between day and night? Meaning the Almighty has given before us, as I start my day, we should know that you have before you the capabilities of separating between good and evil. That's how you start your day. You start your day like you start your week, with the concept of separating between good and evil. Right, following the Torah is the aspect of following the good, and the evil is pushing it away. just to give you like you know a true story about what it means not, you know, not to combine and deviate from the path of what the Torah, you know, demands of us. In Velazhin, there was a yeshiva called Velazhin, and Velazhin was like the father, was called like, you know, the mother of all yeshivot. That was like the source of everything, city and Velazhin, and it had like, you know, it was the mother of all yeshivot. Everything that we have today is an offspring of there. And the Russians came up with a decree that you have to enter secular studies into the school. But the Russians came up with this thing: you have to enter, you know, secular studies into the school. And the Russian Shiva of Volozhin said, "This is too much of a decision for me to make on my own." So he got together all of the rabbis of the entire generation to say, "Should we enter secular studies into the school, or should we close down the yeshiva?" So everybody's sitting there and has their own opinions. One rabbi gets up, the brisker rabbi gets up, and he says like this. He says, "I want to tell you a story." He says that in the times of the temple, the enemy was coming in, and they conquered the temple. I think it was the Romans. And the Romans say to the Levites, they tell them, "We'll let you keep serving on one condition. You know, you have to put our stuff inside your temple as well. But we'll let you do everything the way you want to do it. Just put our stuff into it as well." The Levim went onto the rooftop. They took the keys to the doors. And it says that they stood on the rooftop and threw the key up to the heavens and said, "If we can't keep the temple the way you want it, don't make us responsible at all." And the Midrash says a hand came out from the heavens and caught the key. Meaning, keep it the way I want it or don't keep it. He says, so he came back to Volozhin Yeshiva and he said, "It's not in our hands to decide how. You know, we have to keep what the Torah says." Now again, the Russians were not just trying to get in secular studies, they were trying to get a foot in, and he had that vision to see it. So he says, "We're going to close the yeshiva." They closed the yeshiva of Volozhin. Says that the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin passed away like a month or two later from the sorrow of seeing his, you know, you have to imagine 300, 400, 500 people studying in a study. What happened when Volozhin closed down? All the students went home. What do they do when they go home?
Studied
yeshivas. Hence we have Mir, which was a city in Poland, right? And you have Brisk and Panovich. These are all cities that the rabbi... Now, what's the significance of that? When the Nazis came around and they started just wiping out the Jewish people, the Jewish peoples had yeshivas all over that they could... If they just knocked out one, there was always other ones that were around. So in essence, it was the biggest blessing that could happen to the Jewish people. It wasn't, and everything is an offshoot of that. When you looked at Volozhin at that time, what did you see? A yeshiva closing down. But you didn't know that the Almighty was planning already the salvation for the next generation. So it's the same exact point that we're talking about, is seeing the difference between good and bad. And only the Torah has the keen vision and that knife to slice. That even though you might see something that might be wrong, but in essence, this is the will of the Almighty.